Hi, I'm Jeff Downs, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room today, you know him as the legendary keyboard player and founder of the band Asia. He's currently in Yes. He's been in Yes for years. And ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Jeff Downs. Jeff, how are you doing?
I'm good, Pa. How's yourself?
I am good. We are, you're across the pond, so they say. You're in England right now.
I'm in Wales, yeah, which is, close to England, yeah.
The Zoom thing is kind of amazing that we can be having this conversation right now and at this great distance and see each other. I love it.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I think that it's really come into its own in the current environment, so... Yeah, it's nice. It's nice to be able to chat and to meet people online.
Absolutely. Have you been doing that a lot? Have you been doing a lot of podcasts and Zoom room things?
Yeah, we did. Been doing quite a bit. When we were in full lockdown, it was kind of more pertinent.
Jeff, the reason you're here today is Yes has a new live album coming out on October 30th. It's called The Royal Affair, live in Las Vegas. Yes has quite a few live albums. You guys like to put out the live albums.
Well, yeah, I think this one is particularly special because it was a tour that had a lot of people that I was connected with in the past. You know, like I said, you like Carl Palmer, his band. We had The Crazy World of Arthur Brown and John Lodge from the Moody Blues, and also I was doing two stints both with Yes and Asia, so it was kind of an energetic tour for me, you could say. And certainly it was a lot of fun, and I think it was nice that this one in particular we managed to capture.
That version of Asia had Ron Bumblefoot Thal. He was fronting the band for those shows.
Yeah, Ron, he did a fantastic job. He came in, I'd worked with him briefly before, quite a few years ago, on a project. And, he was such a, noticeably great talent. And I was really pleased that he agreed to step up to the plate. And, he did a great, great job on all the songs that I wrote with John Wetton. So I was very pleased about that we could still go out and do Asia.
He was handling the vocals, and he was also playing, was he playing Steve Howe's part on those songs too?
On some of the stuff, yeah. Steve came and joined us for about three or four songs at the end of the show, at the end of the Asia set. But Ron was doing the lion's share, obviously with the vocals as well.
Right.
It's no mean feat to be able to hold all that together. So, Ron, he did a fantastic job.
And then Billy Sherwood was doing double duty also, right, for Asia and Yes on the bass?
Yeah, well, Billy, we did a big tour the year before last with Journey, which was the first time we'd been out without John, who sadly passed away. That was, Billy came in, stood in for John, and... So it was kind of logical that he would continue when we decided to go out again. Of course, he was playing with Yes too, so it was a lot of cross pollination between the two bands in many respects.
These the prog rock bands seem to be very incestual. Like everyone plays with everyone at some point in your career.
Yeah, I think the British prog musicians have got a certain empathy with each other, and I think that. I did stuff with Greg Lake, I did stuff with Glenn Hughes, not specifically prog, but obviously was in Deep Purple for a while. So I always seem to have ended up with with people from that genre. And, you know, I consider myself very fortunate that I've been able to work with all these people that I, you know, I come a few I'm a generation behind them. So in some respects, it was kind of really neat for me to be able to work with these guys that I got ultimate respect for and was a big fan of.
So the current lineup of Yes, we've got Jeff Downs, of course, on keyboard, Steve Howe on guitar, Alan White on drums, John Davison on vocals, and of course, we just mentioned Billy Sherwood on bass. How do you guys put together a set list for a current tour? I mean, Yes has so many albums and so many songs. It can't be easy.
Yeah, I think we try and dish up a different different set list every time we go out, rather than, I mean, there are some staples in Yes, you know, Roundabout is a kind of staple
sure.
song that it's hard to imagine a Yes show without Roundabout, but certainly we've dug quite deep into some of the other albums, like The Ladder. We did a couple of tracks from that. So some slightly more obscure, what you would say were more obscure Yes albums,
right.
rather than the kind of the big four or five albums that were they're noted for in the 70s. But it's a very interesting thing to do, because I think we have covered virtually every era of Yes at some point, so it's nice to continue doing that.
And do you have a favorite Yes song to play in concert, maybe one that you didn't play on an album, a classic Yes song? When you see it in the set list, are you like are you like, yeah, this one, I love playing this?
I think I'd say And You and I is one of the ones that I really I just think it's a very, very defining Yes song.
All complete in the sight of Seeds of Life with you. Oh, corners and crosses, never know who meant foodless words. Chords are broken, enough inside the Mother Earth.
I think from my standpoint, that's the one I really, you know, I get goosebumps every time that one comes up.
Oh, that's cool.
There are, you know, the Close to the Edge, the track, you know, that's an amazing piece of music. We've just been on the last tour. It's not on the live album, but we're doing Gates of Delirium from the Relayer album, which again is a very, very different type of Yes music. So, it's nice to vary it up a lot, and I think that, you know, I think the fans really appreciate the fact that we don't just go out and play the same set time after time, you know.
Yeah, it's always when I've seen you guys, it's always a surprise, because you guys, of course, like you said, Roundabout, there's like two or three that have to be in the set list, but yeah, you guys really mix it up, and the fans do appreciate it.
Yeah, I think they do, and I think that it keeps us fresh as well. You know, I think that from our own standpoint, it's nice to, certainly from my standpoint, you know, I'm going out there some nights, I'm playing four or five different keyboard players. So it's quite a challenge in a lot of respects for me to sort of try and get myself into the role of the Rick Wakemans or the Tony Kays or the Patrick Myers. So, yeah, it's a challenge, and I think that challenge is a healthy thing.
That's what's interesting about Yes. There's been many different players who played many different parts in the band. You're one of the keyboard players in the history. You're locked in now. You're all in on Yes.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's such a magical band. You know, I think that when you look at the history of Yes and you know, over 50 years of making music, I think that, you know, it's almost like a kind of classical musician's catalogue. You know, it's a composer. You know, it's a whole gamut of music, and that's one of the reasons why I think the band has remained so intact and on top of its game, in that it's very much a musician's band.
Yes.
And, you know, I think that is something that is very refreshing, even in today's world, where, you know, there's so many different, you know, the stars, a lot of the stars today are kind of, you know, they're manufactured or they're on reality TV shows or whatever. You know, to be able to be still be in a band that, you know, is interacting with musicians and making, you know, making great music, I think that's, for me, that's how I started out. So it's very important to try and continue to do that.
Yeah, the members of Yes are definitely playing live. Everyone is in the groove, in the pocket, and they're in sync. And it's just fantastic when you see you guys play.
Well, that's great. Yeah, there's no tricks. You know, it's edgy stuff. You know, being in Yes is not, it's not a roller coaster ride. You know, you've got to really you've got to be on your best behavior. You know, to make it all happen.
Are you guys, how much rehearsal goes in before a tour? I would obviously new songs that are in the set list have to be worked out.
Yeah, I think we tend to do a lot of pre-preparation individually.
Okay.
And then, you know, we'll get together for 2 or 3 weeks before a tour and start really fine-tuning it. So, I mean, you can do so much on your own. And obviously I study, you know, a lot of the keyboard parts in great depth. But, you know, once you get in the room with the other guys, then it all changes.
And right.
You've really got to be, you know, start to modify certain things you thought were that and something else, you know. So, yeah, from that standpoint, we give ourselves a little window of rehearsals, and then we're ready to roll.
After this long in the business, do you guys ever come off stage and just look at each other and think that one wasn't great tonight? Something was up with this one. Do you guys have bad shows after this long, or is everything just always cool?
No, it's you try to get to a certain standard. I think a certain standard builds over the course of a tour, and obviously we're all trying to be at the highest level possible. But sometimes, whether or not, you know, nothing actually, sometimes technical things go wrong, but generally speaking, you know, we've got a fantastic crew, we've got great people working for us. So the actual, you know, the technical aspect is normally pretty good, but sometimes it feels a bit, you know, if the audience is slightly not as responsive as you might think they should be, then that gives you a little bit of a strange feeling.
But, you know, sure.
You if the audience are really behind you in a massive way, then you just go on the ride, you know, and you just literally, you're riding the wave, you know. And I think that's what really makes it for me, is you know, the difference between a great night and maybe a not so great night,
right,
is the fact you've got, you know, that audience participation, you've got the feel of the venue, you know, and everyone's on cloud nine. And
I think,
you know, we get those gigs sometimes, and it's a very great feeling. You know, it's a really uplifting aspect to the whole thing, is that you suddenly feel, wow, you know, this is great. You know, this is fantastic.
Well, whenever I've seen you guys perform here in Los Angeles, it's always at, you know, it's some amazing venue like the Greek Theater, or I recently saw you guys at the Ford Theater, which is a smaller outdoor place. But these venues are just, you know, made for music. And anyone who goes to these venues in LA, we're always into the show. So you guys always get good crowd response here.
They're usually very good atmosphere in the amphitheaters, and we used to play at the, you know, the Gibson Amphitheater, which I don't think is there anymore.
No, not there anymore.
And that was always really good, but it's always been great, LA. You know, there's always been a very receptive crowd. There's always been, you know, there's so many musicians there. We've got a lot of friends there, and it's always good to these guys come back and and hang backstage with us. And it's just like a kind of family, you know. It's great.
And I would think also when you guys touch down in a part of the country where there's not a lot of concerts or where you haven't played before, that people are super excited that Yes comes to town.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, you go through the sort of parts of the Midwest, which you don't often get to. And, you know, they're I wouldn't say grateful, but they're very overly enthusiastic because obviously, you know, a band like Yes doesn't go through that town that often. So I love traveling across the whole of America. You know, I've got great memories of playing in, I think I've played in every single state in America at some point. So it's great to go back and hopefully soon with all this going on.
Well, you brought up Relay earlier. It looks like in 2021, you guys, on the books right now, you guys are going to be playing Relay.
That's right. Yes, we were pretty well all ready to go on it, and then the pandemic hit, and we had to postpone all our plans for this year. So we hope we can get that one back up and running again next year, and that would be the one album that we haven't really from that 70s era of Yes. It's the one album that we haven't actually addressed as an album. So that'll be a lot of fun. I mean, we look forward to that.
Yeah, that album is always the one that's it's a little bit. How do I want to describe it? It doesn't have well known songs on it unless you're a super Yes fan. It's kind of the oddity of the whole catalog. So that'll be really cool and interesting for the diehard fans.
I think because it was the album that Patrick Mraz, the only album that Patrick Mraz played on.
True.
I think he added a whole different aspect to Yes at that point. And I think they embraced that kind of jazz element influence, more kind of rock jazz fusion. So I think that he was, not largely responsible, but I think that he helped to push Yes in another direction, which I think they were looking out for. And I think that it is an oddball of an album in many respects. And I think that, a lot of the real diehard Yes fans cite that as being, one of the holy grail of some, that era in many ways, because of the oddity of it and because the fact that it has all this very, very intense musicianship on it. And it's a great album. I really enjoyed playing Gates of Delirium. That's a crazy piece, and we've got Sound Chasers, even more crazy. So it's a great album, and I think that we'll really go out and have a good time doing that.
All right, let's go way back, Jeff. I'm going to go back to 1981, August. You're in the Buggles, and Video Kills the Radio Star is the first video ever played on MTV.
I heard you on the wireless back in 52, lying awake intently tuning in on you. If I was young, it didn't stop you coming through.
Yeah, August 1st, 1981. I'd say I'll never forget it, but at the time, it was not really what you could say. MTV was in its very formative stages.
Sure. No one really knew what it was.
No one really knew what it was. Video Killer Radio Star had been out 2 years before that, so it was not. From our standpoint, it was we'd already done an album with Yes, and we did a second Buggles album, I'd formed Asia at that point with the other three guys. So it was more of an aside than anything else that someone said, oh, yeah, you know, there's this new channel open called Music Television. And they use your video to open the whole thing. I thought, this was a couple of weeks later. I thought, that's pretty cool, you know. But yeah. I didn't really attach too much significance to it until it really started to get sort of very deep into the American music scene and became a significant player in the game.
Yeah.
almost to the point where it was the market leader in terms of breaking music. I was kind of grateful that I was there at the front end of it. And of course, when Asia came out the following year, it was very significant that we had, you know, the Asia videos were all very high profile on MTV.
Definitely.
And it was, you know, it was the marketing tool for the record labels. And so I think that's one of the reasons why they were so expensive to make, because the video directors saw that as a means of making, you know, a very, very large amount of bucks very quickly.
Right.
Nobody thought anything about a video clip costing $300,000-$400,000, you know. Whereas the weird thing was, we'd make an album for a quarter of that, you know. The disparity of the actual recording of the music, the whole album, and then maybe one song that you know, commercially cost a lot more than that. But it was the way it was. Certainly, unfortunately, they don't seem to play much music anymore. But
no, they don't.
That's the way it's gone.
Yeah. So the timeline's a little bit, I was trying to put the timeline together, but you told me, so at the time Video Kills the Radio Star debuts on MTV, Drama, you've already made Drama, and you're already deep into Asia.
Yeah.
So you're unbelievably busy at this point in your life.
That's right. I think in 3 years I'd made, two Buggles albums, a Yes album, and an Asia album. So it was all with three different, you know, very successful projects, if that's what you want to call it, or bands. I was very, very fortunate that I managed to make all that work for me in a very short space of time.
I want to ask about the Drama album, but I have a question. Someone tweeted a question, one of the listeners. He wants to know if his name's Jesse Alora. He wants to know, was there ever talk of a third Buggles album?
At that point, I think we did the second album after Trevor and I left Yes. Mm-hmm. And we're going now back to the beginning of, 81.
Right.
And we got sort of about halfway through the album, and that's when I got the call to join Asia. So I think Trevor finished the album, the second Buggles album, on his own. And at that point, Trevor was really moving into record production in a big way. He'd started to work on a Frankie Goes to Hollywood stuff. So he was flying as a record producer at that point. And so we parted company, really, mm-hmm. in many ways. And I think that he became, you know, the great record producer that he is
to this day.
And I veered off towards the big and abandoned, playing live music and all the rest of it. So we kind of, it was not a sort of, right, you know, I'm off, you do that, you do that. It was more of a kind of, we followed, I think, the vocation that we each had to do something, you know, along the lines that we felt we wanted to do. And I think that he made the right decision in that respect. And I think I did,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I think you both did.
We both felt, I think, that the Buggles had run its course, because I think that when you get famous for doing a pop record, you you know, you can only take that so far.
Right.
I think that, you know, we weren't a big image thing or anything like that. We're a couple of backroom boys, session guys. So it wasn't like this sort of glam pop band. You know, we were just a couple of record producers.
Right.
And I think that we felt that we'd probably taken it as far as we could. So in terms of being a third Buggles album, we've often talked about it since, and I've worked with Trevor on quite a few projects in the last 10 years, not least the Fly From Here album we did with Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we still talk about doing stuff and...
You never know.
We were due to get together a couple of weeks ago, but of course this second wave of lockdown has made that not really possible. But, you know, we still get on and we still talk about, you know, the Buggles and how it got both of us onto the ladder, as it were.
Now, how do you guys go from the Buggles... recording Drama with Yes, because you guys have your own thing. So why would you want to go join Yes?
I think at that point, I think that we were doing the second album and we'd had some songs forward for it. And we were rehearsing, writing in a studio. We had the same management company, so we got to meet the guys in Yes at the management offices and stuff like that.
Okay.
And it was really just a case of the three, you know, Steve, Alan and Chris were kind of they'd had these sessions in Paris, which fell apart. And I think John Anderson and Rick Wake had left at that point.
Right.
So there were just the three guys. Trevor and I were in the next rehearsal room. And I think Chris came and he said, I really like your album, you know, the Asian Plastic album was really good. Have you got any other songs lying about? So we put on our thinking caps and we took a couple of songs into their rehearsal room that we'd written. One of them was called I Am a Camera, which became Into the Lens. And they said, yeah, this is really, you know, this is really good. We should write some more stuff. So in many ways, it was a sort of morphing of us, you know, because Trevor being the singer and me being the keyboard player, we had our...
Yeah, that's what they needed. They needed a singer and a keyboard player.
Exactly. So we had our chairs, there were two chairs empty there, and we kind of... literally just went in there and morphed into it.
So it's as simple as that. You guys are just recording, you're at the same studio and someone just walks across the room and says hello. And then the next thing you know, you're recording Drama.
Yeah. You know, both Trevor and I were big fans of Yes as well. So it was kind of, wow, this is really weird. You know, we're writing with these guys that we've revered all these years and so it was an amazing experience, and for me, you know, being a keyboard player, it's a pretty revered role, you know, in terms of, you know, the keyboard player on the band. Yes, you know, it's like, you know, there've been these great guys before me, Tony Kay and Patrick Moraz and Rick Wakeman, so they were sort of pretty big shoes to fill in many ways. So I think I I relish the challenge. You know, it was something I felt I could do, and I got on with it.
When I talk to Yes fans, everyone loves the Drama album. It's a really popular album among Yes fans. And, you know, normally when you replace a singer, you know, and other players, you know, that album is under scrutiny. But I think everyone loves Drama. I know I do.
Well, I think the thing was that it's almost taken on in more recent times. I think maybe at the time, the real diehard fans then couldn't really see beyond, John Anderson being the singer. Not so bad for me, really, because Yes had had three keyboard players before me, so I was just number four, you know.
Right.
But for Trevor, it was a much harder thing to take on, which I think he did great on it. You know, I think the album really stands up today, and I think that
it does.
I think what Yes fans really appreciate about it is that it heralded a new era for Yes. You know, so, they could quite easily have gone the same way that ELP went, you know, where they got to the end of the 80s and they couldn't really take it any further.
Yeah.
And so I think that the fans that really appreciated it saw that it opened a whole new door for Yes Music. It was, from the previous album, Tormato, it was a very upbeat, energetic, high-energy album. People really realised that maybe if we'd not made that album, Yes might not have continued in the way that they did. And it certainly paved the way, I think, for what you could call the 80s Yes. And, you know, I had adding a lot more, the technological feel to Yes rather than being, the kind of rustic, a lot of natural imagery in the lyrics and that kind of thing. With trees and mountains and all that sort of stuff. I think that with Trevor's lyrics particularly, we were talking about pylons and, a lot of technical stuff and, engines in the night and all this, all sorts of stuff like that. I think it was a move lyrically as well as it was musically. And I think that helped propel Yes into the next album, of course, which Trevor produced, 90125, but Yes suddenly became, an 80s band as opposed to being a 70s band. And I think that really helped propel them through the 80s, and beyond into the 90s. And, the music still had a lot of relevance at that point.
This is what's interesting then is the 80s, as the 80s happened. Steve Howe leaves Yes, joins Asia. John Anderson comes back to Yes. Trevor Horn, who replaced John Anderson, he stays and produces that album. And then Asia and Yes both have wild success in the early 80s. I mean, who would have thought that after Drama, the band would fracture again, John Anderson would come back, and then everything would blow up big again. And for you, Asia, that's your biggest success sales wise.
In terms of, that album sold nearly 10 million worldwide. It was a huge selling album. I mean, the second album did about 3 or 4 million worldwide. Mm-hmm. So it was a big, it was a big selling for a couple of years. We sold a lot of records. But I think, in hindsight, I think maybe Yes had a look over their shoulder and saw what we'd done with Asia
exactly.
in 1982 and thought, you know, maybe we could do with getting some of this for Yes. And so obviously 90125 came out the following year. And I think that we probably had some influence on that with Asia, that we embedded ourselves at the beginning of the 80s into this sort of not corporate rock, but certainly accessible rock that maybe the 70s bands had they couldn't really achieve anymore.
Right.
I mean, bands like, you know, King Crimson and even Genesis kind of revamped themselves.
Yeah.
Genesis.
Everyone did in the 80s. Everyone had to embrace that
exactly.
the 80s sound a little bit if you wanted to stay successful. And so you had
to.
If
you wanted to continue the longevity of a band, it was the way to go.
You know,
and I think that's why, you know, when Genesis did the whole thing with, and then there were three and they started to make pop records or, you know, they weren't Watch of the Skies anymore, you know, they were, Let's Dance, whatever that song was. it was a strange era in many ways, but, I think there's some fantastic songs were written in the 80s, and I think that, you know, it's obviously, it was my era, and so I can only think fondly about it.
So Asia, how do you feel about the term when people call it a supergroup?
I think that was more to do with a marketing ploy than anything else. I think that, you know, Geffen Records, who signed us, we were the first band signed to Geffen Records. David Geffen had a kind of dream that he wanted to establish his own brand in the marketplace. And he surrounded himself with really, really good people, you know, people who were top of the game and marketing mm-hmm. and publicity. So I think that they came up with this thing, well, you know, the super group of the 80s, obviously we all had pretty good pedigrees. I mean,
sure.
The other three guys, particularly, you know, John Wetton with UK and King Crimson,
yep.
Carl with the LP, Steve with Yes, of course. So, you know, there was an element of, you know, we were all top of the game players, I suppose, at that stage. So it was a term that was bandied around. I don't think it was bad because I think it helped to kind of elevate our image to this sort of pinnacle of,
right.
Musical prowess.
And here's the thing, you guys are all, yes, you all had a great pedigree and you all top musicians, but then you guys write an album with every single track is a winner. Like there's no song that I skip on that debut Asia album. It was my album in the summer. I was 18 years old. Couldn't get better than that.
Fate looks certain, but then nothing's guaranteed. Want for nothing, but it's nothing what you need. Always pushing, though you're never satisfied. I did believe you till I found out that you lied. Time and time again. Time and time again.
Yeah, well, I think it sits together really well as an album, and I think it's got the highs, the lows, it's got the dynamics,
mm-hmm.
it's got pop elements, it's got prog elements, it's got rock elements, you know, it's got, I think that we didn't really know at the time, but I think in hindsight, it is one of those albums that really pretty much had everything right about it, and certainly, you know, the lead off track Heat at the Moment, which was one of the last songs we wrote for the album. But I think that, you know, we people think that we just kind of put it together, but it was actually rehearsed for 6 months in a room in London, and we experimented with all these ideas. I think the other three guys who particularly had come from that sort of prog rock era in the 70s, I think they wanted fresh challenges, and mm-hmm. they wanted to do something different. And so I think that's why we started to craft music more around these kind of melodic rock songs that John and I were coming up with. And but you still had the musicality on there. So it wasn't just a straight ahead rock album, rock songs. It was much more of an in depth, I suppose, almost like a sort of classical rock yeah. album. You know, we had all those musical moments as well as having the big powerful anthemic choruses. So it was I think we did get it right on that album.
You had all those things, and then you had hits. You said Heat of the Moment, that went to number 4. Yeah.
Thing I said that I would never do. A look from you and I would fall from grace, and that would wipe the smile right from my face. Do you remember when we used to dance, and incidents arose from circumstance? One thing led to another. String together songs unsung. It was the heat of the moment, telling me what my heart meant. The heat of the moment showed in your eyes.
And then Only Time Will Tell goes to number 17 in the U.S. I mean, at that point, like early Yes and King Crimson and U.K., and Emerson, Lake and Palmer, they had FM hits, songs that rock fans knew. But Asia, you guys broke the mold, and you had top 40 hits.
Yeah, well, we crossed over, but at the same time, we still had very, very deep in rock radio and FM radio. You know, we had maybe 5 or 6 cuts going simultaneously on that album. So we haven't really had the best of both worlds, I think, in that, we had a lot of depth to the material on that album, and it was really, I think it was the best selling album of the year in America. Yeah. So it had that kind of depth of, approached all generations. You know, it wasn't just like, you're an 18 year old guy or a college student or whatever. This transcended across into teenage girls and to older people who were really into it, and I think that we managed to jump across all the generations with that album, which was probably why it was so successful.
So, who put the band Asia together? Who started the band?
Well, originally I was working with Steve on some material, and then. Then I went off and I was working back with Trevor on the Buggle stuff. And Steve had met up with John Wetton, and they were starting to write some stuff together. And it was about that time that they were looking for someone to play the drums with them, because they were starting to think of this whole thing about a band. And so they got Carl involved. As I say, music business was that nest of musicians was really quite a small pool.
Yeah.
So, I'd met Carl before. Everyone had met up before at various times. So it was really a question of, okay, so we've got the drummer, we've got the bass player, we've got the guitarist, right? Who'll get it on the keyboard player? And they called me up and said, do you want to come and join, see how it works out? And so that's where we got in the room together and we started playing together.
And is this the first time you had met John Wetton, or had you met him in the past?
I'd met him in the management office, because his girlfriend at the time was working for the management company, who was also Yes's management and the Buggles' management. So it was all very kind of incestuous that we knew all these people. And I got to know John socially. And then... you know, when we started, we decided that, you know, the four of us would start forming this band. Mm-hmm. That's when I got to know John as a writer as well, and that's when we started working together and really started to form the foundation of Asian music at that point.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like this meeting with John Wetton, he was your, what do I want to say, most important collaborator then in your life, maybe. I mean, you guys, not only do you have all these Asia albums, you know, after the reunion, and then you have the Wetton and Downs icon albums. I mean, you guys have written so many albums, so much music together. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think we were really a match made in heaven in many respects, because John and I had very similar backgrounds. We studied church, English church music, and you know, we'd had the same kind of influences. So for me, working with someone who was that knowledgeable about, you know, British music, and because we were very influenced by European music. I think that, you know, there wasn't a lot of blues in our music. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of Asia was a very, very straightforward, which I think was one of the reasons why it had the charm. But I think we both had these ideas about these big chorus parts, you know, and the vocal aspect was very important to us. So I think that that's one of the reasons why we went on to write so many songs together, was because we had this inherent understanding that, you know, he'd go with an idea and I'd put one of my ideas there, and we just used to put them together. So it was very much a case of, you know, what have you got? And I'd say, well, I've got this idea. He'd say, well, I've got this, that'll go with that. And that's how it worked.
That's how it worked.
That's how it worked up until the time that sadly we lost John, you know, and it was a great moment of sadness in my life when we lost him, because not only was he a great friend, but he was also, you know, such a great collaborator, and I think of all the great music we wrote together.
You're leaving now. It's in your eyes. There's no disguising it. It really comes as no surprise to find that you planned it all along.
He, I think at one point, I don't know how close it was to his passing, but he had tweeted like a picture of a CD, and it just said Wetton Downs on it. And I think his tweet was something like working on new music. So he was working with you up until his final days, it sounds like.
Pretty much so, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we had some great ideas that were, you know, hopefully one day I will put forward, and but there wasn't really enough in terms of, you know, because John was pretty sick at the time,
yeah.
So he wasn't really too focused on that, because obviously his health was was failing. So, but yeah, I mean, I think that there's stuff there that will eventually see the light of day, hopefully.
Well, I know as an Asia fan, I would love that, but it must be difficult for you to, you know, listen to some of that stuff. I don't know how much time has to pass before you can listen to it and feel good.
Yeah, it's difficult because, you know, I relied, John was very much the lyricist as well. So because I'm a firm believer that, you know, the person that sings a vocal really, you know, has to believe in the lyric as well,
right.
You know, in terms of it to be, you know, convincing. I'm not saying that some people can do fabulous covers of songs that they haven't been involved in the writing of, but I think in our instance, it was it was pretty vital that, you know, John knew the range of his voice. He knew where, you know, that what the sentiment would be in a song, how he could deliver that. So it's a very, very, you know, if you analyze it, it's actually a very, very complex thing, which we never really had to look at because we were both, you know, just rolling along,
right,
and, you know, in good health, and, you know, everything seemed okay. So, you know, sadly, that wasn't the case.
Yeah, John had like a muscular tone to his voice, but then he could sing a song like An Extraordinary Life, and it's just a gorgeous vocal.
Yeah, I think that, you know, he had his demons, and I think that when he came back with the Asia reunion and some of the Icon albums that we did together, his voice was incredibly strong,
yeah,
you know, maybe even stronger than it was at the beginning. And I can remember hearing some of the, you know, hearing some of his deliveries and on stage when he did an acoustic song or something like that, it was actually breathtaking. You know, so I think that he was at the top of his game, certainly on the reunion of Asia. It was you know, we did the Phoenix and the Omega and the Triple X albums. You know, they were a lot of fun because you know, as I say, John was really on top of his game then.
The first time I saw you guys in concert was on the Alpha Tour. You guys came to Pittsburgh Civic Arena. Chris DeBerg was your opener.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And Jeff, it looked like you had about 25 keyboards on stage at that point. You had a stage above the drum riser, and you would just run back and forth. How do you keep that all straight? Like, I saw that and I was just like, I've never seen anything like that before.
Well, I think it was staging as much as anything, but mm-hmm. at the same time, it had this impressive array of technology that I was very into the technology of keyboards. You know, it was my thing really. You know, I got one of the first Fairlight computers,
uh-huh.
And so people used to look at the screens up there because people hadn't seen that before. You know? So that was always a big talking point. And I had a couple of Hammond organs. So I had all this mixture of modern technology and old analog stuff. So it was kind of like a keyboard showroom up there.
And, yeah, it was impressive. I feel bad for the road crew.
Yeah, well, I had to have two guys because it was a lot of stuff. And I think it was really the brainchild of a guy called Michael Tate, who runs a company called Tate Towers. He was originally Yes's lighting guy back mm-hmm. in the early days. And he has a big company now that do the big stages for Madonna and God knows who else. But it was his idea that, we could have this very, very high tensile material that would go above Carl's drum riser.
Yeah.
That would support all the keyboards and me and my two road guys. And it worked out, you know. It was really good. And I think, you know, that was really our stage. I mean, I know, you know, you go and see Genesis or something like that, and they had all the big light show, Pink Floyd or whatever.
Yeah.
That was one of the things that was our staging in a way.
It was impressive. It was very impressive.
Triangular.
Yeah, like the A.
The triangle of the A. And yeah, I mean, I think that it looked really good. You know, I think it was something that I'm proud we managed to pull that off.
And, you know, big hits on the Alpha album. You had Don't Cry. You had Smile Has Left Your Eyes. And then one of the great deep cuts for me on that album is The Heat Goes On.
Well, that was, I think that, you know, the record label were very keen to get us back in there in the studio for the Alpha.
Sure.
Maybe it was the release was a bit weird because it was timed. So the album was actually, we were actually out on tour before the album was released. Mm-hmm. So there was a little bit of, I don't know what you'd say, really. Not, it wasn't really that well thought out in terms of that. And I think that affected us internally a little bit, that we had this situation where it kind of brought in a bit of discord in the band, and that's one of the reasons why I think Steve and John were falling out quite, mm-hmm. quite a lot at the time. So it was a strange time. I think that we made the album in Canada because the accountants had told us that we needed to get out of the country for a tax point of view. So there were all these different things that we were slightly out of our comfort zone.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't say, I think the album turned out really well, considering.
It's a good album. I mean, it's hard to follow up, you know, the performance of the debut, but I think you guys made a solid album. I like it very much.
Yeah, I think it's a good album. And I think that, you know, John and I were particularly under the pressure because the record label, you know, they come off an album that had sold nearly 10 million and, you know, they wanted more of the same.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, even though it's, if you sold 3 or 4 million now of an album, that'd be absolutely
mind boggling.
Right, putting the bunting out, you know.
Yes.
But we were, you know, I think they felt it was, you know, a bit of a disappointment because they'd done so well with the first album. That's always a big problem, isn't it? If you've done so well with your first album and then, you know, you've got to follow that up. And
yeah, expectations are high.
Well, exactly. And I think also at that point, Geffen had started to move into other areas of signing bands, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So we were not, you know, the previous year we'd been at the top of the tree and we were starting to get, you know, move down a peg or two. So all of these aspects, I think, put a lot of pressure on us at the time. And so, you know, I still think that Alpha, there's some great songs on Alpha. You know, I think Open Your Eyes is a great piece.
What on earth are you doing here in the Western world? Another situation. Yeah, you're a different girl. Someone else succeeding, believing.
there's great musicality on the album, but I think that we, you know, somehow we'd lost a little bit of momentum. Maybe we shouldn't have got out so soon. Maybe we should have still been promoting the first album. I don't know. You know, there's a lot of it in hindsight. But, yeah, it certainly put a bit of a, you know, threw a bit of a spanner in the works.
And then subsequently, Steve leaves the band and you get Mandy Mayer, who's like a, he's kind of a heavy metal rock guitarist. How many people did you audition to fill Steve's spot?
Well, I think the fact was that Steve had got a bit disillusioned with it at that time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, him and John were pretty much, you know, at loggerheads. And John had obviously been out when we had Greg Lake in briefly.
I saw you standing hand in hand. Now you come to me a solitary man. I know what it is that ministers such ordinary lives. Where to go, the who to see, no one could sympathize. A smile has left your eyes. A smile has left your eyes.
So I think when John came back, you know, Steve felt that wasn't right for him.
Was that difficult? So, was that difficult for you because you and Steve had a relationship from Yes, and now you're having a great relationship with John as a songwriting collaborator, and now your two your two friends are not getting along.
I know. I felt, you know, I think both Carl and myself were sort of men in the middle. And
yeah.
It was tough times because, you know, you what do you do in that situation? It's kind of an immovable situation. So it was a difficult time for the band and certainly for me, yeah, and for Carl and for everybody, I think. So I think when John came back in, Steve, you know, Steve wanted to move on. And the record label wanted a third album. We were contracted to do a third album. So they suggested Mandy.
Okay.
Which, of course, moved us in a, you know, a different direction. I think that, again, it was, you know, the mid-80s, there were those big power guitars all over the shop.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe we thought that that was the right way to go. I mean, it might well have been. I think that the Astro album has got its moments. I think that, you know, I think that but by that time, we'd been 2 years, you know, after Alpha, we just lost a bit of momentum.
Yeah. Yeah, even in the video for Go, you guys have your hair's kind of bigger and...
It was very 80s.
Yeah, you know. Very 80s. But yeah, you're right. Astra has some great songs. Countdown to Zero, Rock and Roll Dream, and I Love Hard on Me is a great track.
It's hard.
I mean, the thing was, I don't think we had a chance to, we didn't really get out to tour that album either. And, you know, I think that, that we started to move our separate ways at that point. You know, certainly John was more involved in looking at a solo career. Carl was thinking about going back to ELP or certainly working with Keith again. And, I can't remember the timing of it, but I think he went back to Emerson, Lake and Powell, one of those, or Three.
Three was the band that Carl went to.
Yeah, so that was this sort of... and then I was involved with producing, so I produced a GTR album at that point. So we all kind of, you know, after Astra, we all went our separate ways, as it were. And, you know, I think that it was one of the reasons why when we came back together again around about 2005 was that we felt that we'd never really given Asia enough of a chance, you know, after having that huge success to start with. It kind of just went, you know, further and further downhill. In terms of, you know, our togetherness. And so in many respects, I think that's when we came back together again in 2005, we all felt that, you know, we had something to prove and we had, you know, there was still life in the old dog yet, you know.
But you did keep the Asia alive, the Asia name alive for years with John Payne on vocals.
Yeah, so, that's true. We did quite a few albums in that period of time. You know, I had some fun doing that. Mm-hmm. I think there's some good stuff there.
There absolutely is.
And I think that, you know, maybe if we had more backing, it might have been a bit more successful.
But yeah, it was very independent at that point for you guys.
It was. It was tough. And I think that, you know, it was... not necessarily to do with music per se, but it was more the fact that, you know, you have to get, it's very hard to get momentum when you've not got, you know, a label behind you in that period. So without that sort of major label backing, it's really very hard to sustain any kind of high level profile.
In 2005, there's a movie that comes out. It's a comedy with Steve Carell. It's called The 40-Year-Old Virgin. And his character, he has a framed Asia poster in his apartment.
Yeah, I've got one on my wall.
But what was the joke there, Jeff? Were they trying to tell us that Asia fans don't get laid? Is that what they were trying to tell us?
I think that's what they're trying to say. Whereas, you know, I think if you turn the clock back maybe 20 years, it would have been a different story. But yeah, I mean, I think it was really, you know, quite good for us because it brought Asia back in the frame. It was a big film, you know, it was one of the top box office films of the year.
I got a kick out of it when I saw it. I'm like, oh, that's great. That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, we did too. You know, and the fact the song was in the film, so it brought Asia, you know, back to life, but in the cinema. And I think that was good for us. I don't think that anybody felt bad about that.
Good. You guys are in on the joke.
Yeah, it was tongue-in-cheek, you know, and the guy having the poster on the wall, all of that. Yeah, it was cool because, you know, they say, you know, any good publicity, any publicity is good publicity.
Well, I'm about ready to wrap it up. I have mountains of notes for you, Jeff, but I promise that I only keep you an hour. Here's a funny story. When I talked to the people who were setting this up for me, I said that I wanted to do it through Zoom so that we could see each other. And they said, well, we don't even know if Jeff uses Zoom. And I just thought back to that setup from 1982. I go, he knows how to use Zoom.
I am quite computer savvy.
Yes, I knew you would be. So the Asia albums that came after the reunion, I just want to touch on those real quick. Phoenix, Omega. Do you guys call it Triple X or is it 30? What do you call it?
Yeah, Triple X, yeah.
These are
30th anniversary.
These albums had some great songs. Finger on the Trigger from Omega is such a great song. And I urge people to seek those out if they've never heard those four albums, because there's some really good stuff. You guys were doing great work.
Yeah, it's great to have the Roger Dean covers as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's as much as he was aligned to Yes, I think that, you know, there was no small influence on the Asia covers. Mm-hmm. Was, you know, I think Roger did fantastic jobs on those with the logo.
Yeah, he created the logo.
Yeah, the Asia logo stood the test of time.
It really has. It's great.
And it's very identifiable.
So here's where people can find you. You're on Twitter at Asia Jeff.
Two Fs, yeah.
Two Fs, G-E-O-F-F.
And that's it.
And you retweeted my tweet today, so I appreciate that.
I love
the interaction. You can go to jeffdowns.com and you can go to yesworld.com. And the new Yes Live album comes out October 30th, the Royal Affair Tour. Live in Las Vegas. Jeff, I look forward to any new music you make. If you guys make a new Yes album, I'm all in. If new Asia music ever comes with Bumblefoot, that would be cool too. Whatever happens, I'm all on board with Jeff Down. So continue success, Jeff. Stay safe. And what would, if I was going to a play out song from the new Yes album, what would you suggest? What one would you like me to play out with?
I would suggest No Opportunity Necessary.
You got it, Jeff. Take care. Thank you.
Bye, Pat.
Listening for the sounds that you're near. cross, don't you? I know your cross is heavier with every step, but I know a man and he would walk miles for you. Stop, just stay where you are. Told you so. The life you're leading, she won't believe the riches of life. Ooh, no, no. Dawn turns to day. Till the morning light, to wake up and be, wake up and be, wake up and be, wake up and be, wake up and be.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Downs.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on Auto Trader. They're really good at numbers. Auto Trader.